Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and the New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. The Inflation Reduction Act, the official name of the climate bill, has been a very long time coming. Much too long. In 1988, this magazine covered the congressional testimony of James Hansen, a NASA scientist who declared that global warming was bound to imperil the planet itself. Hansen said that it was time to stop waffling so much. 34 years later, the evidence of our collective waffling is all around us. Wildfires, floods, temperature records broken year after year. So while the Inflation Reduction Act is a huge political victory for the Democrats, there's a much bigger question surrounding this bill. What difference will it make, and when? I called up Elizabeth Colbert, one of the very best thinkers on climate. Colbert is a staff writer for The New Yorker, a Pulitzer Prize winner, and the author of books including The Sixth Extinction and Under a White Sky. Betsy, we're talking in a week in which the former president of the United States has had his house searched. He's being questioned in New York. All kinds of things are happening second by second. And yet the week before, we had a political moment that arguably is meaningful for our grandchildren. How do you assess the political moment and the bill that just passed where climate's concerned?
Well, it's certainly, you know, a very significant moment. You know, it was often called the most significant piece of legislation the Senate has ever passed on climate change. As a lot of people pointed out, that was a pretty low bar because they've never really passed a piece of legislation on climate change. But I do think, you know, that potentially it marks a watershed moment.
Well, let's go through the bill, what it is where climate is concerned. What's there that's positive to begin with?
Well, the bill mainly relies on, you know, tax credits. There are a lot of tax credits for industry, so for producing clean energy of all sorts. And then there are a lot of consumer-facing credits, for example, to buy an electric vehicle or put heat pumps in your house, replace your, you know, oil-burning furnace with heat pumps. So it relies very much on, you know, a carrot approach as opposed to a stick approach, urging people, trying to make things cheaper. And I think that the fundamental, you know, theory behind this is if you get some of these industries really going, the prices will continue to decline and non-carbon energy sources will become, they have already become much, much cheaper over the last decade or so. They'll become so cheap that the transition to clean energy will just sort of happen as a result of economics.
Trying to battle climate change is so complex, so international, so interwoven. Is there any way to assess in an empirical way what the effect of this bill will be?
I don't even think anyone honestly has attempted the international numbers, but people have tried to look at the national numbers. And, you know, you get a range of figures about what it will do because part of it is dependent on the price of fossil fuels. Like what becomes tempting to do kind of depends on how cheap or expensive other options are. If you give me a tax credit to buy an electric vehicle and I'm, you know, a rational consumer, let's say, then part of my calculation presumably would be what's the price of gas, right? Right now, gas is expensive, so EV might, you know, look very good in those terms. But if gas prices fall again, you know, it might not look as good. So that's just an example, one example out of many, many that are in this bill.
Now, you say the bill is mainly dependent on carrots, incentives, rather than sticks. What are the sticks that are missing? What would you like to have seen in such a bill that would have been even more effective?
Well, and another version of the bill, you know, when it was back in the days when it was called Build Back Better, there were penalties. And one of the, you know, issues that we're dealing with here is there are two parts to this clean energy transition. One is constructing new energy sources, putting up new sources of energy that don't emit carbon. And the other is backing out the sources that do emit carbon. So both of those have to happen.
Concessions were made, to say the least, in order to get the support of Joe Manchin. And they include drilling in Alaska and the Gulf of Mexico and other concessions. How damaging were those compromises to the larger effort that you described?
Well, you know, if you look at, once again, the analyses that have been done, they would say that they were fairly trivial compared to the good that the bill could do. Now, a lot of people were very upset about them. We can't be burning more fossil fuels. That's just incompatible with the project of fighting climate change. And if you can't acknowledge that and can't say that, then it's not clear how far you can get.
Betsy, how do you feel about the name of the bill, the Inflation Reduction Act, the way essentially they're hiding a climate bill behind a fig leaf of inflation lowering?
Yeah, I think that unfortunately speaks volumes. The fact that the Democrats didn't want to go out there with a climate bill, wanted to go out there with an Inflation Reduction Act, I think is unfortunately pretty telling about our climate
but
politics.
This is something that's very hard to fathom. I understand why people want inflation to come down. Everybody wants that to happen. But at the same time, no one goes unaffected by climate change. At this point, everyone is seeing it, whether you're living in spitting distance of you know, extraordinary fires or just the general heat that's affected us in so many ways. Who is unaffected by it? Who is able psychologically at this late date to turn a blind eye to what is facing us all?
Well, I mean, that's such a good question, David, and I have spent a lot of time thinking about it. I certainly do think that this summer, a lot of people should have gotten the message. But, you know, we've run pieces and many people have run pieces of, you know, just going out and talking to voters who are being directly affected. You know, I have to sell my cattle because there's, you know, not enough water. And people find ways. This has just become an ideological issue. What we've found in recent years is that ideology is really, really powerful. And people can believe even in the face of overwhelming evidence, even when it's really hurting them. I mean, we just saw these incredible floods in Kentucky, a red state. Is Kentucky now going to go vote for people to, you know, who are firmly committed to climate action? I sadly don't expect that to happen.
What is the ideology exactly of disbelief in climate change, of trying to ignore it, of putting it off the political table?
Well, I think that climate change, if you really start thinking about it, it does raise a lot of issues that do intersect with people's ideology. And ultimately, you know, George Bush famously said back in, you know, the early 90s when he signed the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, you know, our way of life is not up for negotiation. Well, climate change challenges that. Our way of life may not be compatible with dealing with climate change. And when you come to that, when you come down to that realization, then I think it raises for people a lot of very visceral concerns. And it's, you know, and I can understand that.
How would you spell them out? What are the specifics of it?
Well, you know, for example, I mean, I'm a trucker. I'm a, you know, there's a million economic interests and jobs that are potentially affected if you say, look, our priority is fighting climate change. You really do have to rebuild the American economy from the bottom up, because right now, pretty much everything we do is dependent on fossil fuels. The way that Americans have always lived, you know, you can call it, you know, exuberant, or you can call it wasteful. You do the you pick. We live in suburbs, very much spread out suburbs. People are, you know, especially after COVID, going back into their cars. All the ways that we live that potentially do have to be rethought because they're very energy intensive. And so I think that people would really rather just say, well, it's not happening, or it can't be that. That can't be my driving around, cannot be responsible for, you know, this flooding that just happened. It's just easier to feel that way.
Now, the bill hopes to get people to buy electric vehicles and make their homes more energy efficient. Can we make a real difference by making these kinds of changes in our daily lives? And how far does this get us? You know, if the process needs to be far more radical, what does it need to take in?
you know, if we all drove electric cars, and there are a lot of cars in this country, you know, and trucks, if they were all converted to electricity and that electricity were generated from carbon-free sources, it would make a very big difference. So that is the case. Now, you know, the other issue with climate change is it ramifies throughout the world. The U.S.'s emissions, which historically speaking, we are the biggest contributor to climate change. The U.S. is responsible for a quarter of the CO2 that's up there, added CO2 that's up there. So that's huge. Mm-hmm. But we are responsible for, going forward, we're going to be responsible for a smaller and smaller proportion because, you know, other countries' emissions are still rising and ours are declining. So this problem, you know, it's not one that gets solved, okay? That's another political problem here. You do not solve climate change. You simply make it worse or less worse.
A bill doesn't get passed and we then have a sunny and breezy summer next time around.
Exactly. Yeah.
Do you think that this new bill will have any political effect on other countries, and particularly the countries that are, along with the United States, the principal culprits in warming?
Well, you know, one sort of sad thing, or problematic, let's put it that way, is that, you know, this bill is coming right after Nancy Pelosi, you know, went to Taiwan. The Chinese announced, well, we're not going to cooperate with the U.S. on a bunch of issues anymore. And one of those was climate change. Now, does that really make any difference? I can't tell you, but the Chinese, who now are by far and away the world's biggest emitter on a year-by-year basis, you know, they are also suffering. They had terrible heat waves this summer. They are suffering tremendously from climate change, and they know that. The leadership certainly knows that. And they, like us, you know, are trying to be leaders in these new technologies. But also, like the U.S., they are very focused on immediate economic growth. And whenever there's sort of a dip in growth, you know, the leadership then, you know, tries to pump up the economy. And that often involves and has recently involved using a lot of coal. It's really, really hard to say. I think one of the questions, and it's a big question mark, is, you know, do these new technologies get developed that turn out to be, you know, both carbon-free and cheap and convenient and all the things that we look for in our technologies? And I'm not just talking about, you know, your electric car. I am talking about these huge industrial processes.
Well, let's talk about two crises at once, and arguably the two most urgent, which is climate change, and at the same time, a not only national but global movement, not everywhere, but in so many places, toward authoritarianism and away from either democracy or democratization. How do you relate those two things?
I think it is very interesting, and I think it is possible that we'll look back in history and say, you know, historians will connect them. They'll say, these people were facing a crisis and they turned to authoritarian governments. You know, people do these scenario building for climate change. And one of the bad scenarios for climate change is rising nationalism. Everyone is just siloed and does what they think is good for themselves. And that might involve, you know, burning a lot of coal if you've got coal. You know, I think there's in the climate circles, you know, governance circles, there's a sort of general sense that nationalism, rising nationalism, is not good for climate change. But, you know, perhaps there'll be some benevolent dictator out there who will show us the way to actually make changes, which have been hard to make in a democracy as well. You know, I think we have to be honest about that.
Are you saying there's a tension between democratic government and fighting climate change?
Well, I mean, so far, if you look at this country, you know, we just haven't seen a tremendous amount of political support for fighting climate change, that a lot of people would argue this is, you know, a ginned up controversy. It's been ginned up by the fossil fuel industry. And I think there's a lot of truth to that. There's been a tremendous amount of misinformation. There's been a tremendous amount of fossil fuel money that's gone into campaigns, but we haven't mustered the political will in this country, in this democracy, to really do take meaningful action until, you know, just now. How's that? You know, now I would say in Europe is much further along than we are. The EU has much more comprehensive legislation. And I would say some people, a lot of people would probably say that the EU countries rank higher on the scale of democracy than we do. So I don't think there's necessarily an inherent tension, but I do think that, you know, we do have to acknowledge that so far democracy has not risen to the challenge.
What is the further responsibility of a country, a rich country like the United States, when I see that Congo, for example, is going to increase mining, deforestation, just as we see in Brazil? And those countries explicitly or implicitly say, look, we are developing countries. This is the only way we can make our way out of poverty, someplace like Congo, for example. What is the responsibility on a place like the United States or Europe to answer that really urgent challenge that, if left untended, makes the problem dramatically worse?
Well, I think it's a huge responsibility. I mean, we are the historical emitters, you know, between the U.S. and the EU. So we have a really big responsibility. And, you know, I don't think there's any standard that you could use, honestly, by which we have lived up to that. I mean, the Americans always tout their quote unquote leadership on climate change. The U.S. has actually been constantly at the forefront of blocking a lot of climate action, right? I mean, Donald Trump withdrew from the Paris Treaty, which, you know, didn't even have any mandatory provisions. You know, just withdrew out of pique. There was a fund that the basically wealthy nations agreed that they were going to devote $100 billion a year in financing to developing countries for both clean energy development and adaptation. That's supposed to be $100 billion a year by 2020. They've never met that goal. That is, I was just talking to someone in Bangladesh just the other day about this, and he said, you know, it really shows that they don't give a damn. And I think that is the message that we've put out time and time again, and that message has been received.
Betsy, maybe we owe ourselves maybe a day, maybe a week of self-congratulation after this bill, but when we wake up, what's the next step? What is absolutely necessary in your view?
Well, you know, the challenge is on so many fronts. It's basically huge research and development push. It would mean streamlining a lot of permitting for these projects. One of the issues that we're going to increasingly get into is siting a lot of these clean energy projects, siting solar, siting wind, siting offshore wind. So we probably need to change some of our regulatory regimes. And we need to figure out whether that is by penalizing or putting a price on. We need to figure out, as I said, ways to back out this carbon energy. We can't just add the clean energy. We have to close down the natural gas plants, the coal plants. We need to rebuild our grid. This is huge. So a lot of this is, you know, pretty boring, technical, technocratic stuff that needs to get done.
Elizabeth Culbert, thanks so much.
Thanks, David.
Elizabeth Culbert is a staff writer, and you can find her work on climate change and much more at newyorker.com. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. More to come.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. John Seabrook has written for the New Yorker on many subjects, but he's a particular expert on pop music, how in today's music business, a track is built layer by layer by an entire team of composers and producers. Recently, John took that close attention to the process of making songs to a very different kind of sound environment. Here's John Seabrook taking a little trip with our producer, Gofen Emputabwele.
So let's imagine we're walking through London in the 19th century. You know, it's 1859, and it's a beautiful sunny day, and we're strolling down the high street. What do we hear? What does it sound like all around us? It's going to sound pretty different than walking through New York City sounds today. I think, first of all, you're going to hear the clip-clop of horses' hooves, and you're going to hear wagon wheels. You're going to hear church bells. You're going to hear running water, probably. You're going to hear more animal and bird sounds than we can hear today. You're going to hear blacksmith's hammers, which have a particular sound. They go ping, ping, ting, ping. They kind of have a ping, ping, ting, ping sound. And if you grew up in a farm, which I did, you get used to that sound. And maybe what people wore, of course, they didn't really have sneakers, so the sound of the feet probably hitting the pavements, the boot heels, are probably like a constant staccato, low-level kind of click, 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 click. So in 1860, the very next year, there was a Belgian engineer who patented the very first commercially successful internal combustion engine, and that was going to change the urban soundscape profoundly.
And how does an internal combustion engine work?
Internal combustion is a rather violent process of igniting gasoline vapors inside a controlled area, in this case a piston sleeve. When the gasoline vapor explodes, it makes a loud noise, and that drives the piston down through the sleeve, which then cranks a gear, which eventually ends up moving the wheels. And you have four or eight of those pistons, or even more, and firing, you know, at more or less the same time, which creates a ba 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 ba. It's a very loud machine. If you actually listen, it's a low kind of low-frequency rumble or growl that really forms the baseline of urban life.
So now that we've talked about the internal combustion era, prepare to say goodbye to it, because we're entering a new era.
The era of electrification.
There we go, electrification era.
And it's going to have a huge effect on the way cities sound.
Why?
Because by 2050, cities have rules that say you can't operate an internal combustion engine in the city. So there are these kind of benchmarks that cities hope to meet in terms of reducing emissions. You know, these are sort of projected goals or guidelines, 2035, 2040, 2050. You hear different dates.
But the point is well taken, which is that sooner or later, we're going to be electric.
All the sounds, not just the engine sounds, but primarily the engine sounds, will go away. A city full of silent cars sounds kind of nice, but think about it, like really walking around, bicycling, crossing the street. I don't know. I think it would be kind of scary.
Yeah, it sounds kind of creepy, actually.
Like the silent city.
Yeah.
In a way, remember the pandemic? Remember like in the worst, you heard the sirens or the ambulances, but what was kind of creepy about it if you're in the city was like how quiet it actually was. But also the problem is that many people, pedestrians and bicyclists, but also blind people, use the sound of engines to navigate the streets. So a quiet car, a silent car, presents real dangers to some people. And a federal law was passed in 2011 that requires all electric vehicles to make a sound, and we have to figure out what they're going to sound like.
Totally, 100%. Yeah. I'm Connor Moore, executive creative director at Listen, who's an audio branding agency based in Brooklyn.
When Ford was thinking about sounds for their Mach-E, which is their first electric car, they consulted their own engineers, but they also reached outside of Ford and work with this company called Listen.
And we reached out to Connor to listen to some of those sounds of the Mach-E.
The guys who make these sounds are basically electronic musicians.
Point. I mean, I'm counting five guitars and two keyboards right now, and I'm looking at you.
So they're kind of working the way that you would work to make an EDM track or like a backing track for a hook or something.
All right, so let's get into the sound.
Sure, yeah. So the welcome sound is, you know, once you get into the in-car experience, and it's a chance for the car to kind of set the tone for your driving experience.
John, reactions?
I was getting kind of a rock and roll vibe there. That could be the beginning of a production of maybe like an 80s, maybe a European hair band.
I have an initial partially Stranger Things reaction. And then I have a sort of like, it reminds me of certain video games that I grew up with. This is like in Mega Man. Could you maybe play it again? But before you do, tell us what to listen for.
Totally. So I'm going to point a couple things out. So within the composition itself, it has this pulsing build, right? That is how we express dynamics and energy. Beyond that, you know, you're gonna hear a low end frequency, a really robust bass frequency response that really pushes this bolder feel, right? And then in the melody, you're gonna hear some kind of crunchy distortion. The original Mustang had kind of a level of independence, this rebel nature to it. So you're hearing much more layered system, a cinematic approach, right? We wanted to really push this soundscape into the future. All right, so playing the welcome sound here.
Okay. It's like do 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 do, right?
Yeah. That's actually a good thing that I didn't mention earlier is when you're starting something or you're welcoming something or you're stepping into something, you compose it in a way that's kind of upward scale, right? An ascending note pattern to where it's opening to an experience, whereas something like a farewell or a shutdown sound might be going downward.
Cool. You want to do the farewell sound for us?
Yeah.
It's very exciting. I feel like it's an exciting sound.
You know, it's chariots of yeah. fire, I think. It's not fire, yeah. They're chariots of electricity, but yeah, very cinematic.
So this is the seatbelt chime in the Mach-E. The way that we think about designing for something like a seatbelt warning is it's a low level alert, right? So we think about it on a spectrum. It's like low level, medium level, high severity.
Say you had to, you got to keep the same notes, but I'm going to tell you that now I want the alert to be like, this is something serious. What process would you go through in your brain to be like, okay, I'm going to adjust this way?
Yeah. So the first thing I would do is I would change the pitch range. I would shift it up an octave. See how that feels, but you want it to live kind of in the, you know, 1,000 to 3,000 kilohertz space. That's the most sensitive area for human hearing. Number two, I would address speed. So the repetition in the notes, there's, you know, obviously a certain amount of space between the notes. I would probably tighten those. And I would probably tighten up the repetition cycle. The cadence of it would be faster. The other thing is I would maybe potentially add a little bit of dissonance, right? There's an opportunity with severe alerts to add some some of that minor modalities, layers that might increase the tension, you know, that's going to really reflect the severity of the moment. The way that I really think about it is it's about the interaction, right? What are you trying to express? If it's a successful state, if it's a confirmation, we're probably going to live in the major, you know, territory, right? Major key. If it's an error state, you know, we think about that as, you know, injecting minor feel or diminished feel, you know, to really get the point across that, hey, there's a problem here.
There was an author, a Canadian author, his last name is Schaefer, who wrote a book called, I think it's called The Tuning of the World, and it was in the 70s. But his basic idea was that nature has an ecology of sound in which birds sing in different frequencies, and they don't overlap or compete. They kind of fit into a sort of an ecology of sound. And he contrasts that to the way the soundscape of cities evolve without any real acoustic designer at work. And so people like Connor Moore see electrification as an opportunity to kind of have this big reset.
We have the ability now to really design sound. Taking the example of a phone ringer or the original alarm clocks, right? They were all consistently loud, right? They hit you loud and they ended loud and they were consistent. Now, when we design these types of moments, it's all in the hope and light of bringing beautiful sounds into our soundscapes that don't bring too much noise into the world.
We as a civilization don't get this chance that often, the chance to really profoundly rethink the way cities sound. Maybe it's a once every 100-year chance. There's a lot of studies that have been done that show that sound pollution, noise pollution has a detrimental effect on your health almost as clearly as, smoke and toxic fumes pollution. So the people who are actually exposed to the noise the most tend to be the less advantaged people. So I think when we think about, you know, improving the sound of cities and making cities quieter, it's far more than just an aesthetic experience for the, metropolitan mind. It's an actual public health question for those who live with engine sounds, motor sounds, highway sounds, horn sounds, suspension sounds, all these sounds that you're in the midst of in the city, we can make better through design.
Continue for half a mile. In 800 feet, turn left onto Washington Avenue.
We've been talking about alert sounds, but there's also a whole set of propulsion sounds the car makes for the driver to hear.
So sonically, we're hearing what, in my brain, normally I would think of, like, the engine is going, like, when we're going forward, the propulsive sound. But that sound is artificial.
That's an artificial propulsive sound. And it's, we took the Mach-E out and drove it in Williamsburg, and I'll tell you what, it was pretty quiet. Maybe too quiet.
Staff writer John Seabrook. He's the author of The Song Machine. And John writes about music, and he's a connoisseur of sound. All kinds of sound.
We all know what a Geiger counter sounds like. You know, that. But of course, that's a completely symbolic sound. You know, radiation doesn't actually sound like that. But and I can't imagine that there's a better sound that... What would be a metaphorical sound for, like, oh no! Get out! I don't know.
Yeah, that's funny. I like that as an exercise. Like, you have to replace the Geiger counter with a new sound.
Fuck!
Oh my gosh.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. Stick around. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. 2 weeks ago, supporters of abortion rights won a surprise victory, maybe the first victory of the post-Roe era. It was in Kansas, not a state normally known for its progressive politics. A proposed constitutional amendment would have allowed state lawmakers to enact a total ban on abortion, but it was defeated by a very wide margin. Democrats around the country, of course, wanted to know how they did it. The ads featured voters in Kansas like a woman who identifies herself as a Catholic grandmother.
It could ban any abortion in Kansas, even when a mother's life is on the line, or with rape or incest. If it were my granddaughter, I wouldn't want the government making that decision for her. Vote no.
And an interesting twist to the pro-choice messaging is that they borrowed a familiar theme from conservatives, government overreach.
This confusing constitutional amendment is a slippery slope for Kansas. It gives government more power over your privacy and your personal medical decisions.
Peter Slevin covered the Kansas vote, and he talked about the politics of privacy with Ashley All, a spokesperson for the coalition called Kansans for Constitutional Freedom.
Did you ever think as a Democrat you'd be running a government overreach, anti-government overreach campaign?
No, but you know, I mean, I think it's actually like a much more complicated message. If you think about some of the slogans for pro-choice organizations, bans off my body, my choice, those are absolutely, you know, variations on the same topic. And we can talk about personal freedom, equal rights, and personal liberty. And those are all absolutely values that Democrats share, moderates share. Progressive share.
We'd love to talk about the ads. Mm-hmm. Tell us what the process was in choosing the characters for the ads.
Yeah, I think, you know, for us, it was really critical that we find diverse messengers for a lot of these ads. We wanted to make sure that people could see themselves really identify personally with either the individual who is in the ad or the situation. And so that is really what we focused on. And we were able to work with folks from communities across the state to participate.
So let's hear one of those ads.
As a pastor for over 50 years, I counsel and pray with individuals facing difficult personal decisions. Sometimes those conversations are about abortion. As Christians, we are instructed to love one another. We do so when we respect and trust women as God does. I'm voting no on the proposed amendment because it replaces religious freedom with government control. It restricts women's rights and it puts their very lives at risk. Join me and thousands of Christians in voting no.
What was your thinking, Ashley, in that message and in choosing a retired pastor to deliver it?
In Kansas, it was really important for us to have someone of the faith community participate in these ads because for a lot of Kansans, that is core to who they are. And for us, we wanted to make sure that people of faith understood that you could both be religious or be spiritual, but also support access to abortion. We actually released a long list of pastors and clergy from numerous denominations who supported access to abortion, and we're encouraging people to vote no.
Let's listen to another one, and perhaps you can tell us the backstory.
They call it a constitutional amendment. The truth? It's a strict government mandate designed to interfere with private medical decisions, a slippery slope that could put more of your individual and personal rights at risk. The ballot language is confusing, but one thing is clear. Kansans don't want another government mandate. So on August 2nd, send a message. Say no to more government control. Vote no on changing the Constitution.
Now, that ad doesn't mention the word abortion. Why did you do that?
You know, I'm not sure that that was, like, particularly intentional with that ad. I mean, I really think that we were focusing on the government interference portion of it. This definitely picked up on some cultural cues that really resonated with Kansas voters and things that they were concerned about, and were an easy way to demonstrate, you know, just how problematic government interference with personal decisions can be.
And just to be clear, those cultural cues, what visuals stood out in that ad to you?
You know, I mean, we were just talking about faith, and there was, I think, a sign that says something about, you know, churches being closed and mask mandates and things like that. And so we were intentional about that. And I think for some Kansans, that was something that they did not care for. Other Kansans, I think, were less bothered by it. But for us, we wanted to make sure that we were connecting with a broad set of voters across the political spectrum who had differing opinions on government interference with private medical decisions.
In devising this ad campaign, you got a lot of attention. There was an extraordinary amount of coverage of what went on in Kansas. And I understand that you have heard from advocates and people working on campaigns in other states who want to know what you've learned and what they might be able to use. I believe Kentucky was one of those.
Absolutely. There has been an incredible amount of outreach to us about what we did here and how unique it was, how successful it was. You know, one of the things that we really learned, and I found maybe the most interesting, was when you talk to real people about this issue, it is not partisan. It is something that people find to be incredibly personal, incredibly complicated. It's, you know, to some, it's a private medical decision. To others, it's a moral and religious issue. And so you have to be able to have a conversation where you give people space to have their own personal views, but also at the same time ensuring that they want to join you in supporting, you know, access and protecting constitutional rights for their neighbors to make these decisions for themselves.
Peter Slevin is based in Chicago, and you can find all his reporting on the Kansas vote and much more at NewYorker.com. For today, we're going to close things up by getting outside with the poet Ada Limón. Limón was appointed the Poet Laureate of the United States in July. And some years back, she moved from New York City to live with her boyfriend, now her husband, in Lexington, Kentucky. Fewer rats and a lot more horses. Limón's book, Bright Dead Things, was all about adjusting to a new home and the constant talk of thoroughbreds.
Hey there.
This is Cactus.
Hi, Cactus. Beautiful quarter horse.
You know why I call him Cactus?
What?
Where's his name?
Oh. We met up with Ada Limón in 2018 near Lexington.
We're standing in front of the main entrance here to Keeneland, and they've got this beautiful stone walls, and it kind of looks like a castle. Keeneland, I think, is one of the prettiest race courses in all of the United States. Now, this isn't where the Derby happens. Churchill Downs is where the Derby is raced, but Keeneland is a beautiful old track that has this very historic, stately feel in the middle of beautiful horse pastures all around it. It feels like spring might actually come. The sun's not quite up. It's a little cloudy. Being here when it's empty is kind of lovely. So right now we're walking through the main track area before we get to the actual racetrack. So this is where you have the concessions, where you get your popcorn and your Kentucky's burgoo, which is a sort of legendary Kentucky food. I'm not a huge fan, don't tell anyone. You get soft pretzels and popcorn and, you know, soft ice cream for the kids. And then as we keep walking up here, you'll see all of the betting windows. I grew up going to the track occasionally with my stepfather, who loves to play the ponies. But we would go to the Sonoma County Fair and go to the track out there. People always ask me, you know, what you have so many horses in your poems. What are they a metaphor for? And I think they're not really a metaphor. Like, out here, they're just horses. The very first time I came to Keeneland, it was here to meet Zenyatta, who is a famous filly who I just adore. She's famous for having won the Breeders' Cup Classic, the only filly to have won the Breeders' Cup Classic. And she was sort of a icon of mine, and so it was fun to get to meet her. And that was actually the very first time I came to Keeneland. I think one of the things I love about watching them race is the thrill that they seem to get from it. Like, they actually seem to be enjoying the race. So right now I'm looking at the main track, which is a dirt track. It has almost like a reddish quality. And it's loose dirt, even though we got some rain. It looks like it's bouncy. They try to keep it so it's healthy for the horses to run on. And then the track right behind it is the turf. Now, right now, we've got a thoroughbred going by, a thoroughbred racehorse. There's something about them that is so beautiful as they race. And as they just stand there in the pasture, and out in here in Kentucky, you know, they're about as common as birds. This area right here is the apron, and this is where, if you just pay general admission, you can come and sit and stand on the rail and root for your horse. On a busy day, it will just be packed and loud and ruckus. It's a great sound. I kind of like coming out here when there's no one here. It feels like there is some sort of ghost of energy within the space, as if it's, you could almost hear the echoes of roars. People screaming with joy because they actually won big for the first time. This is a poem I wrote for the Kentucky Oaks Day, which is when all the fillies race, and it's one of my favorite races. How to triumph like a girl. I like the lady horses best, how they make it all look easy, like running 40 miles per hour is as fun as taking a nap or grass. I like their lady horse swagger after winning. Ears up, girls, ears up. But mainly, let's be honest, I like that they're ladies. As if this big, dangerous animal is also a part of me. That somewhere inside the delicate skin of my body, there pumps an 8-pound female horse heart. Giant with power, heavy with blood. Don't you want to believe it? Don't you want to lift my shirt and see the huge, beating, genius machine that thinks... No, it knows. It's going to come in first.
The poet Ada Limon at Keeneland Racecourse in Lexington, Kentucky. She was just appointed the Poet Laureate. You can find some of her poems at newyorker.com. I'm David Remnick. That's the New Yorker Radio Hour for today. Thanks so much for listening. See you next time.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Merrill Garbus of Tune Yards. This episode was produced by Emily Botine, Ave Carrillo, Brita Green, Kalalia, David Krasnow, Louis Mitchell, and Gofen Mputubwele.
Along with Jeffrey Masters, Wu Colley, and Michael May. And we had assistance from Harrison Keithline and James Napoli.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.